When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Court Jefferson came to me about
it. Totally reduces us to a stereotype.
It's patronizing, and that's Jeffrey White.
White, not Jeremy Allen.
Not Jeremy Allen White.
White, right, White.
Okay,
like really, but like being a very grounded intellectual exposition plot in a larger film, you can't simply warp through time.
Yeah. Like he's in the Hunger Games, isn't he, and stuff
like
that.
The artificial intelligence has gone sentient.
What you didn't realize about things is. Yeah. There is magnificent aliens above us.
He does a lot of that in Westworld.
He sort of rushes and slows. He does the rush slow.
He does the, I'm coming up with this, but how profound.
If we can't realize the aliens' potential, how can we defeat them? Anyway, American fiction.
Sorry, you just inhaled a colony of bacteria in the milk.
So I obviously make a cup of tea when I'm here at James's. And James has a very bad habit of having milk in the fridge that expired 100 years ago. And
I have new
habitually,
milk.
You didn't tell me that. I just saw the one. I habitually always sniff milk because there's nothing worse than making a nice cup of tea and then you pour the milk in. And
it comes out as cottage cheese.
I mean, I feel like I'd cracked open Tutankhamun's tomb and just like wafted in an age old. I feel like I've got an Anaxunamun in my face now.
Yeah. I'll never forget as a runner once, like doing office admin and like little office tasks. The head of production was like, James, whenever you're free, the staff fridge has just got a couple of things in it. You have to just go through and get rid of things that are out of date. And I was like, yeah, like I was really busy, so I never got round to it. And I actually got round to it like a week later. And the sight, the office fridges sometimes, because no one's responsible for it. People forget lunches. There was a jar of pesto. To this day, I think I opened it and a hand like reached out to grab me. But it got so bad that it was fluffy around the rim of the jar. Like the mold had like broken beyond the void of space. It was looking for a new food source.
The Last of Us.
Literally.
That's why you got to do weekly cleanings out of your fridge at an office place. Very boring, but like someone.
This had been like, you know, half a year.
Oh, at least.
Of just people leaving things. And I remember like it stunk up the kitchen. Once you start getting all out, awful. I sent a company email around.
Did you?
Yeah. I was like,
please, could you dispose of your lunches?
It was more funny. I think the subject was, you don't know what I've seen. And then I just like told people, please
don't do that.
Yeah.
I went to a nice film experience last week.
Oh, yeah.
I went to the cinema at 3:30 on a Wednesday afternoon to see not a current film, I went to see an old film, I went to see All That Jazz, which I won't be reviewing on the show, but it's if anyone wants to see a Bob Fosse movie from the 70s, go see it. And it's very hard to find. Mm. And that's why I wanted to go see it, because I was like, oh, they're showing it at the Prince Charles Cinema, which obviously in London shows lots of old things. Mm. And when I booked my tickets, it was a fairly sparse screening room. And I thought, that's fine.
Yeah.
And then when I get there, first of all, packed, absolutely packed. And I'm like, packed to the point, every seat was taken, that I thought, I must be here for the wrong film. Because I was thinking, surely you're not all here
only
to see.
I would like this.
No, but it's just more like, there was a huge cross-section of people there. I mean, talking young, old, arty, non-arty. And I'm like, surely you're not here all to see Bob Fosse's 1979 film, All That Jazz. Because like, I've been tracking this film for years. I've been waiting to see it. But sure enough, everyone there was. Mm. And what I didn't expect from this cinematic experience was that it was a piece of film. It was a reel of the film from the 70s. So it comes up with the old BBFC. Well, I don't think it was even called the BBFC then, like yeah. National Film logo. And
like the holdovers, but legit.
Literally like legit. And it's like all that jazz. And the frames are so scratched. There's really? So much debris on yeah. each single frame. And at first you're like, I can't watch this. It's like watching someone sketch over the image. Yeah. But actually it gives it such a nice quality. Mm. And also the color had changed, had aged of clearly of the film stock itself. It had yeah. this kind of reddish, slightly faded yeah, look shift. On it, which you get used to. Mm. But looking at it first, I was like, oh wow, I'm looking at watching a genuine historical article here. It was quite nice for a change to see that.
It's interesting, like you're like seeing a piece of history being bled through light.
Yeah.
Very nice, yeah.
And I realize how conditioned we are to expect to see things in 4K remastered. Even from the past, you're like, why isn't this pin sharp?
Well, the trend now is that, you know, we design cameras and lenses that have no profile, no character, no distortion, no vignetting, no barrel. Like, and now we are adding those back into our films. Like the best filmmakers shoot with vintage lenses from the 70s because they like character. But in like commercial world, you want to get rid of chromatic aberration and character. You want the cleanest image because you're usually being paid for like a high quality product. Whereas in cinema, you're like, actually, I want the character introduced back. Like the new Arri Alexa camera, which is like the camera that wins all the Oscars for cinematography, has film stock presets within the camera, and you can choose the size of your film grain, the roughness of it, how much of it there is, like baked into the image. You can basically choose a stock.
That's very cool. But that's why it's
you can't tell anymore.
But you can choose it. That's the thing. Whereas in the past, that was all you had to shoot with. And now it's like, now you can choose it. Yeah. Welcome to episode 114 of Pulp Kitchen. Don't know why I paused. I forgot where I am. Where am I?
It's right behind you.
Last week we reviewed Society of the Snow and All of Us Strangers. And can I just say, we got a great response to both those films. It was really, all week, we had emails dinging in and comments on the YouTube video and comments on the social post. It was really nice to hear everyone's response to those two films, which have really struck a chord. And I'm sure we'll get to some of those in the emails later.
I feel like Society of Snow, of the Snow, really picking up with the film fans.
Yes, really, it's really...
I'm really tempted to see it. I might try and do it this week.
Yeah, and it has... I was looking at the numbers. It has been this hit. And it's quite interesting when recent weeks, when you and I have talked about how films, when they go on Netflix, they seem to disappear.
Yeah, the streaming service sort of rollout can be conducive to films not getting the legs that they deserve.
But this is the opposite. This is a film that's gone onto Netflix, had a limited theatrical release, but went onto Netflix and has become a word of mouth hit.
And that accessibility, once you hear the word of mouth, oh, and it's on Netflix, which has quite a critical mass from film consumers, people having, right? You're like, oh, great, I'll just go and flick it on, watch it on a Tuesday.
And also, but also with limited sort of marketing push, like it's become a sort of a global hit because people are just saying, well, this story's really amazing, you've got to go and watch it. So that was really nice to see. And J.A. Bayona, director of Society of the Snow, even followed us back on Instagram, gave us our review, a little bit of a share. So that was really awesome. So if you haven't listened to those, go and listen to
him and the lead singer of Busted follow us.
And Zoe Ball. And
somebody else
recently followed us. Oh, and Benedict Wong.
Oh, yeah, Benedict Wong, an Avenger. Benedict Wong, I don't know if you're listening, but hi.
Yeah, hey.
Just anyway,
big
hi.
Big fan. Love to see you and stuff.
We must collect them all. Collect all the Avengers.
Yes.
Yeah. Like we can start with the periphery assistance to the actual Avengers, but we'll take them.
So that's
Big Fat Falcon would be good. Anthony Mackie.
Well, he's no Falcon anyway. He's now Captain America.
True.
So
how dare I? Yeah.
We were so close. Oh. We would have got him. We have three films to review for you today. Three. I know you're thinking, what, two? But no, today we're doing three. Two of which are Best Picture nominees for this year's Oscars. We'll be reviewing American Fiction and The Zone of Interest, as well as, completely differently, Argyle.
We also had a chance to go to a Q&A with Jonathan Glazer for The Zone of Interest, so we'll give thoughts on that. But it will be part of the review, but him talking about the film afterwards, our impressions of the film.
And I know what you're thinking. Three films sounds great, George, but I'm always left wanting more. Well, good news, because as ever, there's a bonus coming, as there is every week. And this week we'll be talking about
Netflix's One Day, starring Amber Kamad and Leo Woodall. We saw a little cheeky preview of it, I want to say, over 6 months ago. And it's out. There was a film with Anne Hathaway and Jim Sturgess from, I want to say, 2014.
Jim Sturgess, what does he know?
Yeah, I know. He's always popped up in things.
Yes,
I've never seen him, no offense to Jim Sturgess, have like a really consistent run of films.
No.
He's always been like,
have you seen him
21 with Kevin Spacey? And
has he been in anything in the past of note? Sorry to Jim Sturgess. I'm sure you have. I'm just
not off the top of my head, no.
Mm.
But yes, this is the Netflix show. Very much sort of a child of normal people.
Yes.
In my eyes. I don't think this show would exist without the presence of and the hit of normal people. But we'll get onto that in the bonus.
Absolutely. That's coming later this week. But for now, three movies to talk about, which we will begin by doing now. Gordon Jefferson came to me about
it. It totally reduces us to a stereotype.
It's patronizing and... That's Jeffrey
White. White, not Jeremy Allen.
Not Jeremy Allen White.
White, right, White.
Okay.
Can't believe. I always think he's better being a very grounded intellectual exposition plot in a larger film. You can't simply warp through time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he's in the Hunger Games, isn't he, and stuff
like
that.
The artificial intelligence has gone sentient.
What you don't realize about things is there is magnificent aliens above us.
He does a lot of that in Westworld.
He sort of rushes and slows. He does the rush slow.
He does the, I'm coming up with this, but how profound.
If we can't realize the aliens' potential, how can we defeat them? Anyway, American Fiction, written and directed by Cord Jefferson, who is predominantly a TV writer, wrote on things like The Good Place and Master of None, but also HBO's Watchmen, which was a fantastic series, based on a novel by Percival Everett called Erasure. American Fiction stars Oscar-nominated Jeffrey Wright, Tracy Ellis Ross, Oscar-nominated Sterling K. Brown, Issa Rae, Eric Alexander, Adam Brody, and many others.
Love seeing Adam Brody in anything.
I thought exactly the same
thing. I thought he was
thing.
Really good in this.
I like Adam Brody because I'm like, you look good. He's quite handsome.
He looks great.
And I think he can always do comedy and seriousness. He can kind of dip his toes.
Yeah.
He's quite, I find him quite a magnetic screen presence.
I'm always just reminded of Seth Cohen in The OC, and I just have such a soft spot for that character and him as an actor. And he pops up in so many weird things like Jennifer's Body and Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Yes.
And this.
He's around.
Yeah.
Anyway, the story of American Fiction is this. Jeffrey Wright plays Thelonious Ellison, called Monk by everyone.
Great name.
Thelonious Monk. That's why he's called that. He plays a curmudgeonly college professor. Is there any other kind of college professor in movies?
No.
I'm thinking this,
ironically,
the Holdovers,
it's a stereotype.
And Dream Scenario. That's the past like three
what
months
is it
alone.
About the sort of intellectual professor? Is it because they're just...
They're so smart, but they're
always sort of depicted as being way smarter than other people, therefore nothing surprises them or interests them.
And therefore they are also isolated and lonely. Yeah. But yes, so I'd like to see a movie just about a standard, normal, happy, tenured professor.
But the irony about a film satirizing stereotypes kind of has a professor stereotype with it.
Anyway, so a curmudgeonly college professor who hasn't written, he's a literature professor and also a writer, but he hasn't written in years, hasn't been published in years. He finds himself on a break from academia, kind of against his will, and ends up reconnecting with his family back in Boston. And this is a family that is kind of very much in flux. It's kind of this end of a dynasty feeling. They have this fantastic, gorgeous home. The mother is showing early signs of dementia. The sister is struggling to keep it all together. You have Sterling K. Brown being a distant brother who is has just gone through a divorce, having his wife has his wife has discovered him as in bed with another man. So now he's openly gay for the first time, and he's out, but he hasn't seen his kids, so he's very depressed. And Jeffrey Wright returns, a monk returns to this kind of strange family dynamic. And at the same time, he's thinking about his lack of success. He's very much in a rut. And he's starting to realize that, in a very sort of satirical point, that if he actually wants to get published, if he actually wants to answer the demands of a very white publishing industry, he needs to, in effect, black up his writing and reduce his writing to black stereotypes and exactly what writing for what white people think they want to hear. And you kind of get this satirical, what I think is being sold as the plot of the film, but I will say it's actually very much just a subplot of the film, this satire about playing up black stereotypes in order to succeed with white authors and a kind of a white audience. Like I said, that is being sold as the main point of the film, but actually, and to my surprise, is very much a subplot of the film. The film is much more interested in this kind of family dynamic and family drama with Jeffrey Wright at the center. Oscar nominated for Best Picture. Like I said, two acting nominations there. I think Best Adapted Screenplay as well. American Fiction, James, what did you think?
I had quite high expectations going in, given the talent involved and the Best Picture nomination.
Yeah.
But when I watched it and came out of it, I think for me it's probably one of the softer picks for Best Picture nomination, my my opinion. As you said, it's sort of got, it fights from these two fronts, which I think the family drama sort of light comedy side sort of snuck up on me a little bit.
Yes.
And I didn't really expect that coming. But what I think is really funny is the central satire of American literature, American characters. There's a really funny moment where he's just flicking through TV and it's like, and now some of the great cinematic pieces of yes. African-American history. And it's like cut to montage of slavery, ghettos, gangs, yeah. violence, poverty. And it is very funny in dealing with a white audience and a white publisher on that side, I think is really well done. I also think, obviously this is what this film is all about, but it is very rare to see middle-aged, middle-class black people in cinema
Absolutely.
Depicted as part of a sort of middle-class liberal intelligentsia trying to deal with problems as such as where to put our mother in a care home. You do not see black characters really yeah. portrayed in this way, and I do praise it for that, and I do praise it for pointing its pen at the other side and laughing. And I think most of that satire is done well, and I did laugh was in those scenes. What I think disappointed, I think the great performances from Jeffrey Wright, and I really like the conception of his character. Again, not my, I think a soft, and Sterling K. Brown, who I really like, a soft pick for best supporting for me, to be honest.
But not taking Andrew Scott's place.
Yeah, yeah, like totally, absolutely. I think for me, where it's sort of, it starts with sort of two central themes and it fights from two fronts. And the more and more I watched it and the longer it went on, it seemed to kind of unravel for me. Mm. And unfortunately, I thought the ending was disappointing and didn't commit to something that I think this film really could have led to. Yeah. And I think that stops the film from being keeps it to being a good script and stops it from being a really great one that had something to say. I didn't like the ending. And if you've seen the ending, you know what I mean. I think this film, because it was bold with its satire, should have committed to something. And I feel like it was a little bit of a cop-out ending for me. And it leads so hard, I don't think it knew where to take it, leads so hard into the satire, and I was less interested in it towards the end. So a little bit disappointing considering my expectations, but I didn't have a bad time with it. I just never really got swept up in the film as a whole.
Yeah, I agree with you. In fact, I even think I feel just a tad less favourable towards it than you. Disappointing is definitely the word I thought when I came out of it. I think that My disappointment was that, I mean, you called it central satire. I do think that idea,
satire,
but that's the thing, that idea of him playing up black stereotypes in order to sort of like trick a white industry is really interesting. Yeah. I think it's a great concept. And I think that's, like I said, that's what the film is being sold at. And I think that is so juicy. And I kept thinking, this is underexplored, because you get a scene of that followed by four scenes of family drama. Now, I don't mind the family drama necessarily being in the film, because as you say, I think it does a really great contrast of, on the one hand, in order to be professionally successful, he's having to play up black stereotypes, one-dimensional black characters.
And the financial element, he needs to pay for his mum's
But on the other side, you're getting a three-dimensional family dynamic, which I totally understand from a script point of view, a structural point of view, why we have that dichotomy between these two elements. However, I just didn't find the family drama very interesting.
Yeah.
And like, I think Sterling K. Brown's character is a perfect example. Sterling K. Brown, great actor, does a good performance, but again, a bit of a soft pick. He's not in it that much. And his character, on paper, is fascinating. A black middle-aged man who has been closeted gay and is going through a divorce and is now openly gay for the first time in his middle age, right, and is depressed. He is unfortunately kind of relegated to being very sort of super, almost just comic relief. He's going through this kind of depression where he's taking a lot of drugs, drinking a lot, and I'm like, that character deserves more. I'm not saying that character can't go through those things.
Yeah,
I was like, I think that's, he's more interesting than Jeffrey Wright's character.
Yeah.
But I would also like to be let into that character's world. I'd like to feel Sterling K. Brown's pain. That's crazy, the stuff he's going through. But then throw on top of it what's happening with his family and his mother. I would have liked to have been let in. So if you're going to give this much time to the family drama, really let me into those characters. Really get me into it. And I never did feel that. I just felt like I was spending a lot of time in this family home, not really connecting to anything, which is a shame. I think that
that lack of direction to me, followed by the ending, which I don't think made a decision,
no,
makes me look back on the rest of it and be like, well, you were kind of meandering around here.
I also think that when it,
that's as if it had gone, this is, if it had a really great rounding full stop to the point it was trying to make, it would have, I think, just sort of snapped the rest of it into focus, but it didn't.
I got quite restless, actually. I have to say, I wouldn't say bored or anything. Like I was with it, but I just did.
I was checking my watch.
I did get restless, and I'm thinking, I understand that you're not going to do the Saturday we're going to do. Mm. The family drama really isn't as interesting as I think you think it is. Jeffrey Wright's character, I'm getting quite tired of, actually. Like, Jeffrey Wright, great actor, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Doing good performance. But like, Monk as a character is quite tiresome, actually. Deliberately so. Sure, I'm not saying I have to like him, but I found his presence incredibly sort of, after a while, quite stale. Like I said, surrounded by very interesting characters. Mm.
I thought the funniest moments are sort of, don't fall funny, out. Funny's beyond.
Funny's I'd say a strong word for this. Like, well, I'd say chucklesome,
like,
witty.
Beyond like an SNL sketch of like, when he's with his agent and they're on the phone to the publisher. Yeah. Those were some of the moments which I thought were good.
And I wanted more of those.
More of that. Totally more of that. Like when he goes for lunch with Adam Brody. Yes. I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
But for the rest of it, my screening was finding it a lot funnier than I was.
Huh.
And me and Talia were just like, I maybe like chuckled a couple of times. Mm. Other than that, I did feel like other people were enjoying the film a lot more than I was.
So
maybe we're not.
But I did come away thinking, I'm surprised that's been nominated for Best Picture. Can I be very cynical?
Yeah.
I almost think there's a slight thing of life imitating art with very white film industry, a very white academy has gone. Oh, amazing.
Oscars can't be so white.
A brilliant, like in the film itself, got a brilliant black story and a brilliant thing pointing out.
You've laughed at us. We find it so funny. Yeah.
And I'm like, the film has some great moments. And actually towards the end, there's a great scene between Jeffrey Wright and Issa Rae about the heart of what's happening, about the publication of this film.
Yeah.
And I was like, I really wanted more of that. But I think the film is not as good as I think the Academy thinks, and
the white professor comes in and goes, what are we talking about?
Yeah, literally.
That's
funny. I kind of feel like...
And I thought that ending was such a cop-out.
Yeah, but I think that's what's happened with the film in the real life, is it's kind of been swept up, because I think people have put a lot of pressure on this film to mean something greater than it is. And I think, everything you say is there. Multi-dimensional characters, family drama that you don't normally see. It's just not terribly compelling.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's American Fiction.
I'd love to hear if other people had different thoughts to us, or if you received it slightly differently, or if you agree. As always, sending your thoughts to hello@popculturepodcast.com and we will read them out on the show. So, George, you went to go and see Argylle.
I did.
Big film.
The big movie at the moment. Big, and not just big, it's on the side of buses. Yeah. It's had a book tie-in.
Junkets.
All the stars coming to the premiere.
In that very, I think, an aesthetic I'm growing to slightly dislike, which is a very Matthew Vaughan, sheeny gold title, tartan fabric with like a title over it.
I'd actually like to know your...
Kingsman, Man from U.N.C.L.E.
It's not tartan, but I know.
What is it? Blushed bonquette.
With the diamonds.
Diamonds,
There's a specific word for it.
Which they're using Kingsman as well, because I think because of the suits. They have like a sort of like a suit material for Kingsman.
For that pattern. It's not checkered. It's like...
No. It reminds me of like a
jester. Like a jester.
Jester, yes. Like a jester, like a nice bonquette on a train.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
That's the sort of...
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yes, so Argylle, which is a new $200 million movie directed by Matthew Vaughn. Matthew Vaughn, of course, who made the Kingsman movies, three of those. He also made Kick-Ass,
X-Men Layer First
Cake,
Class.
X-Men First Class. And
I really like Matthew Vaughn films until I don't.
Right. Anyway, Argylle has a cast, a galaxy of stars. Henry Cavill, John Cena, Bryce Dallas Howard, Sam Rockwell, Bryan Cranston, Samuel L. Jackson, Ariana DeBose, Catherine O'Hara, and that's not a spoiler, one scene, Richard E. Grant. So they're all in there.
Amazing.
I mean, just throw him there.
Put him in everything.
Put him in everything. Thank you very much. Oh, and Dua Lipa as well. But I forgot to mention her because she's in the movie for about as long as she's in the trailer.
She's not what the poster wants you to think. They want you to think it is a
Henry Cavill
a spy
Dua Lipa
comedy
movie.
Starring Henry Cavill and Dua Lipa.
So the premise of Argylle is thus. It's an original script, an original idea by Matthew Vaughn. Ellie Conway is a spy writer, spy novelist, and she has a successful series of novels called Argylle. And in the Argylle world, which we see recreated before our eyes, the spy of Argylle is played by Henry Cavill in a velvet, ridiculous suit, looking like a very buff waiter, and a flat top haircut, which looks ridiculous. But it doesn't matter because it's a fantasy world; it's a fiction world. Mm. He has a sidekick played by John Cena and Ariana DeBose, and he's a smooth talking Bond pastiche, right?
He's so ready to play Bond and everything but Bond.
Yes, he's too old for Bond now. He won't be Bond, but maybe he'll be a Bond villain one day.
Bond. I think it would have been a solid Bond.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the real world of the film, Ellie Conway, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, is these books are incredibly successful. Mm. She's doing very well, but she's very lonely and she just lives life with her cat, played by Matthew Vaughn's cat, Big Whoop.
Is it in the credits as Matthew Vaughn's cat?
It just is his cat. Yeah, I don't know what the name of the cat is, but by the way, Matthew Vaughn married to Claudia Schiffer. Did you know that? The model. For like years as well. Like a new thing. Just there. And I noticed a few Claudia Schiffer books made their way into the background of certain scenes as well.
That's shameless.
Yeah. Anyway, she plays a successful novelist and she, like I said, very lonely. She decides to go and visit her mother one day, played by Catherine O'Hara. She's on the train. And what happens, of course, is that Sam Rockwell, in full sort of Jesus beard and hair, sits down in front of her, who reveals himself to be an actual spy, a real spy. And he says to her, you have to come with me, in a very sort of, spy movie thing. You have to come with me because your life is in danger. You're in great threat. And she sort of goes, what? No, damsel in distress, reluctant heroine, pulled away and whisked into a world of espionage, full of spy movie cliches, blah, 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 blah. Here's the thing about Argyle. If you have followed the news recently, you'll know that it has got some excoriating reviews saying it is one-star reviews everywhere, one of the worst films ever made. I can just say I don't have as strong feelings about the film as that. Mm. I don't think it's a complete car crash, but it is not very good. And why is it not very good? For a couple of reasons. First of all, for this film to work, it's a silly film, and that's fine. I know it's a silly film. Matthew Vaughn knows it's a silly film. Mm. We're all on board with it being a silly film.
We don't mind silly.
We don't mind silly.
Dungeons and Dragons was silly and it worked.
We got time for silly. For this film to work, though, it has to be fun and it has to be a little bit funny and it has to be witty and kind of a bit smart and do something. Mm. It's not funny. It's not charming. It's not fun. It's charmless, lacking charisma. Yeah. And incredibly derivative. Like, that's what's so sad. I saw it and I thought, okay, well, it's a new IP. At least we're not getting a fourth Kingsman movie, we're getting Argyle, which you've created, which is great. But it's less original than an existing IP. It's the same thing we talked about ages ago when we talked about Don't Worry, Darling, which looked like an original film, but was actually so nothing derivative original. Of everything else. There's nothing original in it. So, literally derivative of everything. The whole reluctant heroine, freewheeling hero dynamic between her and him, Sam Rockwell and Bryce Dallas Howard, has just been done so many times. I was even seeing like a bit of The Mummy, between Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz in there, done much better in The Mummy by that. Yeah. And actually Matthew Vaughn has said he wanted to kind of, he was taking inspiration from a film called Romancing the Stone, which is a very swashbuckling with Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner. But so that kind of dynamic, like I mentioned about The Mummy, is there, but much better in The Mummy. Just much better and more charming. Great. I think Sam Rockwell and Bryce Dallas Howard don't really have any chemistry at all. So it's also derivative of Matthew Vaughn films.
It looks like a Matthew Vaughn spoof.
Where Matthew Vaughn, he does in this film what he's done for the past few films, which is, cartoonish, over-the-top set pieces, fighting scenes, right? Slow-mo, camera doing around, full of moments of humour. I'm fine with that. That's okay. But I have seen that before, quite a few times. And also with Kick-Ass and with Kingsman, those scenes of ridiculous cartoonishness were then punctuated by real scenes of violence. So you'd have like the church scene in Kingsman, which is crazy, but you'd have people getting actually shot and you see actual blood. Or in Kick-Ass with Hit Girl, when she's going around with her blade, like you're seeing people actually getting, it's given a little bit of grit underneath its fingernails. Mm. Problem is that this is cut for a 12A. So all the cartoonish sequences remain cartoonish and flat and uninteresting. And people get shot and they just sort of fall to the ground. And not that I'm like a bloodlusting, waiting for violence, but I'm like, these scenes are meaningless. Yeah. And they're just derivative of Matthew Vaughn. The script is really, it's just not funny. It's not charming. And it's baggy. It's like there is humor in there, but the pacing of it is so baggy and the timing is so off. I was like, oh my God. The first, I'd say, 10 minutes, I was actually on board with. It begins with a scene from Argyle in which Henry Cavill has to escape and he has to chase Dua Lipa and it's set in Greece. And I was like, I'm fine with this. I can see that it's tongue in cheek. I'm okay with that. I recognize that the dialogue is deliberately hammy, deliberately silly. I'm so fine with that. The problem is that when that scene finishes and you go back to the real world, you realise that the dialogue is equally clunky and equally bad in the ostensible real world. You're like, oh, the film is not getting any smarter. Now we're back in the real world. Also, that opening sequence, however much I was kind of on board with it, I couldn't help but think that this was done better 20 years ago in the beginning of Austin Powers 3. Do you remember the beginning of Austin Powers 3 where it's like a chase and it's full of action? It's a helicopter. Yeah. And then at the end, it's like, it's Tom Cruise playing Austin Powers and it's Gwyneth Paltrow Danny DeVito is Mini-Me and it's like Steven Spielberg's directing it. And it's a nice fun thing. And I was like, that's more entertaining. That was funnier 20 years ago. And in fact,
let's go full spoof.
Ghost of Austin Powers kind of lingers over this. I've not seen an Austin Powers. I haven't seen Austin Powers in a long time. And I'm sure it doesn't hold up, but I was thinking, like, what more do you have to offer here in terms of a Bond pastiche? Specifically,
has something to say,
but also specifically pastiching Bond in the 60s as well. That kind of camp stuff. I was like, we did this, we did this 25 years ago with Austin Powers. What are we still doing here? The script is weak, and I don't begrudge the actors for trying their best with it, but I have to say, and I wouldn't normally single something out, but Bryce Dallas Howard. She seems like a lovely person and she has been in better things, but
she directs a lot. She directs Mandalorian.
I'm afraid that every time she is on screen, the film dies. Yeah. It's all borderline expressionless at times.
Really?
And it's every time the camera cuts to her, it's like a charisma vacuum. I'm sorry. I know this sounds incredibly harsh and I know she's not working from a great script, but she is the main character and the film really hangs on her. And it's like a train shunting to a stop every time she was on screen. And you know what makes it worse is that she's opposite Sam Rockwell, who is one of the most charismatic, charming actors around, like up there with like Mark Ruffalo, can bring so much. Yeah. And I have to say, Rockwell carries this movie. He's got Argyle marks on his back from having shouldered this movie for 2 hours and 20, by the way. 2 hours.
2:20. Yeah. Mark right off. Yeah,
exactly.
No.
So that's it. And as a result, I'm kind of watching this it's not boring. It's just a bit dull because it's a very empty experience. It's like when you just keep consuming crisps, even though you know you should stop and the bag never stops.
You just
keep putting it away. And it's baggy and it's flashy and it becomes quite in a way like...
So flashy.
It's like quite a bit of obnoxious way of losing $200 million.
Yeah.
I was looking at this thinking, this is $200 million, so much talent, so much style for what?
It looks like the shop front of a premium luxury designer.
Yes.
Flashy.
Yes, it is. Flashy, overpriced. Empty. Originally, it was meant to be just for streaming and then with Apple TV and then Paramount. I think it's, no, not Paramount, it's Universal. They were like, oh, we're going to make this a big release. And I'm sorry. It's not a disaster. I wasn't angry with it in something the way I was like Five Nights at Freddy's, which was just making me seething. I was just sat there thinking, what's this? I saw it with my girlfriend and her mum, and they both liked it. They said it was kind of fun. They chuckled along, and I was like, fine, but I didn't hear anyone else laughing.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of just watching things on the screen. Most people watch this film on a plane.
Yeah, and, oh my God, it'll be a plane film.
They will sleep through it and they'll wake up and they... Because the plot is also incomprehensible and silly and also tied to nothing. The essential premise once Sam Rockwell has taken Bryce Dallas Howard is like, oh, this shady government organization headed by Bryan Cranston wants you because everything you write in your novel seems to come true. And like, you're on the... So we're going to go to this place and like, we don't know what happened to this spy after this certain point. So maybe like, what would you say would happen in the book? And I'm like, okay, so you're telling me as an audience member that basically the plot is going to be written in front of my eyes. You're literally going to make this up as you go along. The character is going to make up what happens, not based on any sort of discernible skill. It's not like, oh, I'm going to have to use my real intellect to hack into this thing or whatever. It's just, oh, let me think. Well, I guess the character would do this. And I'm like, that's boring. Yeah. That's not interesting. What can I do with that? Come on, Argyle.
It's interesting how, like, genuinely before the reviews came out, it looked bad. It looked sheeny. It looked flashy. And I just don't think, maybe because we're quite pressed to the ground, a film telling me that it's slick isn't enough for me to believe it is.
The more
it tries to show me that it's so cool and slick, and maybe it's going to be a satire of that, am I going to go like, oh, wow, yeah, slick film.
I knew it was off because, like, I couldn't really tell you what the central like hook. There's not a hook for this film. The tagline of the film is "The greater the spy, the bigger the lie." What the hell does that mean? Yeah, what does that mean? When you look at that on a bus, what does that tell you?
Yeah.
Nothing. Okay. Yeah. When I saw the poster for One Day, two people, 20 years. I get it.
Yeah.
It's easy.
Break your heart.
The greater the spy, the bigger the lie. That sounds desperate. Like that tells me you don't know what this film is about.
It will sit next to the sort of Ryan Reynolds action comedy graveyard, RIPD,
yes,
Six Underground.
And what's that one he did?
Hitman's Bodyguard.
Red Notice.
Red Notice.
Yeah.
Like very slick, very sheeny.
Yeah.
Sort of comes, goes, great paycheck for Ryan Reynolds or whoever was involved with the sort of contract for a streamer.
I think it ends with also with a bit of like sequel bait as well. Mm. I'm like, oh, I haven't talked about the most egregious thing in it. Sorry, I didn't say. Yeah. Here's me saying, oh, I didn't find it particularly obnoxious, but then I did. So the Beatles had a new song out last year. We talked about this, right? The final song.
Yes, you did.
And it's a great song. It's a really nice story about how that came together. It works really well. Not only does that song feature in this film about three times, it's actually part of the score. They take the main melody of Now and Then and they work it into the score. So it's like playing over any sort of romantic scene or any sort of like threat. It's just in there. It becomes the sort of the motif.
Beatles, yeah.
And I'm like, why is this in this movie? Because you have a song that's a piece of genuine artistry and you have this, which is a piece of nothing.
Yeah.
Why are you... stop ruining Matthew Vaughan. Stop ruining this song for me.
It's funny because like 10 years ago, I would have probably thought, oh yeah, like Matthew Vaughan could probably direct a really good Bond film. But I think the films he's made in the last 10 years make me think, please no, I don't want Kingsman Bond. I don't want, I don't know, that brand of subverting it. But anyway, that was Argyle, guys.
You.
If you managed to catch Argyle and you had any similar thoughts or disagreements, please send them into hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. We'll read them out on the show.
Please note how I took one for the team there, because James, I said to James, I was like, oh, I'm going to see Argyle with Anna and her mum. Yeah. And you were like, in that case, I'll leave it to you.
Yeah. I've seen plenty of shit. I've seen plenty of shit for this podcast that you've not seen, so I won't hear it.
Like what?
Blue Beetle.
Yeah, that's true.
Some DC one. Seen Multiverse of Madness, Quantumania.
Yeah, well, I saw that. I did see those eventually.
Yeah, but like in time for the show.
Yeah,
so we could have a review out. Yeah. I saw it. Yeah, I would have loved to have watched it on Disney Plus 3 months later in my own time. But yeah,
Argyle.
Shifting gears slightly, actually quite a lot.
Yeah.
Shifting gears a lot, resetting to The Zone of Interest, directed by Jonathan Glazer. We were very lucky to get to go see it at the BFI IMAX with a Q&A with Jonathan Glazer. I think it was Mark Oddie, who is his production designer and maybe his cinematographer. Forgive me for not. It was three of them up there talking about the film. Mm-hmm. Directs films very infrequently. I think it's been 10 years since his last film. He did Under the Skin, which I actually watched last night. It left me in quite a weird mood, but it was also striking and brilliant. Sexy Beast, which got a Paramount Plus show, which we got to see two episodes of the other day. Loosely adapted from a 2014 book by Martin Amis, which I've not read. I assume you've not read it either. Yeah. The film is shot around the family of Rudolf Höss, who was an SS officer in 1943 and who was the longest serving commandant of Auschwitz. And I think Jonathan Glazer very clearly said the film is shot around and involving Rudolf Höss. But he said very clearly, I'm not interested in making a story about the life of Rudolf Höss. It takes place around him and his family. It's not necessarily a biopic or a story about him. He was eventually executed in 1947 during the Nuremberg trials. And so this film is set adjacent to the atrocities of the Holocaust. Höss's family are situated in a fairly large domestic house whose back garden, lovingly attended to by his wife, played by Sandra Hüller, shares a wall with the Auschwitz camp. It's not a field over or a few places down the road. It literally, on one side, is a garden and a house and children playing in a pool and going about their days as a normal German family. And on the other side of that same wall is the unspeakable atrocities that took place at Auschwitz. It's shot with many characteristics of a documentary, and he talked a lot about this process of capturing this family in a certain way. There are very much shots that are capturing life as it happened. There's almost no camera movement. I see a couple of times the camera does move. It tracks the characters along the wall and sort of along thing, but very much sort of on sticks, matter of fact, shot round the corner, seeing this family as they are. And from the very opening of the film, I think Jonathan Glazer very clearly wants to indicate to the audience that you need to use your ears, you need to listen. And the sound is one of the most important aspects of this film. We start with film with a lot of blank vision on screen, silence originally, a title screen, the ramping up of introduction of score and sound. It sort of immediately indicates, please listen. Listening is what is very important in this film. And we're never given a visual confirmation or a visual aid to the atrocities that you hear. You only see brief glimpses of trains bringing people into the camp over the horizon, a slight angle of the entrance, of one of the entrances, I assume, into the camp. Shots, you know, and just a subtle indication of what might be happening. Like there's a shot of the family having dinner and in the window is smoke rising from an incinerator. It's also set during a particular time in World War II. It's set in 1943, where if you know anything about Holocaust history, the Nazis were starting to ramp up Hitler's final solution. It was the ramping up of the full industrialized extermination of Jews in Europe on a mass scale. And the film sort of shows you some of the details of how that was discussed and how that carried itself out. George, we got to see a really interesting conversation. We got to see it on the biggest screen in the in the UK, which I actually found watching a film on a screen that big with subtitles was a little bit like playing flicking visual tennis.
Up and down.
My eye, like, obviously, this film's so visually arresting and it creates this very still watching experience. But my eyes are sort of jumping up and down trying to catch the subtitles. But George, The Zone of Interest, very powerful film. How did you get on with it?
I'll begin by saying I think it's a really interesting piece of work.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about it at length, but as a word, I would say it's just chilling. Bone chilling. And unfolds this quiet horror. Just on like the methodology of like Glazer's approach to the film, which I think is really interesting, you just touched on. It's like, what's clever is that Auschwitz in the film is in a way what the Holocaust is in our consciousness today. Something that is both very immediate and also made peripheral.
Yeah.
And that's what we live in, a time when, you know, it has never been more urgent, never been more relevant. And the scars of that period, you know, still exist. And yet there are huge factions of society which deny its existence, downplay it, and seek to kind of alter the facts. And I think that's a really interesting sort of visual metaphor straight away. And Glazer spoke about being very aware of the kind of the way the world was changing when he was making the film. It took 10 years to make as well, because he makes things with incredible precision, and you can tell.
I quite appreciated, by the way, like hearing him discuss the film and witnessing his demeanor, the way he talks about his art, and seeing how he would have gone about making it, and the time he takes, and obviously the process of which he made it as well.
And he refers to this whole construction of the film. Like he said, there is the film you see and there's the film you hear, as you just talked about. And like you said, the film you see is all about Rudolf Höss, but the film you hear is the film he actually wanted to make. And the whole Rudolf Höss perpetrator perspective is a framing device through which you can look, you can capture the horrors of the Holocaust. And he used this term in the Q&A about the grotesque domesticity of the banal existence of Höss's family in that house right next to a death camp. And he talked about carefully constructing the environment to make it a period. They reconstructed Höss's house, but they made everything inside it incredible 1943 period detail.
Yeah.
And they minimized the presence as much as possible of cameras, and they didn't want the actors to feel like they were on a film shoot. They wanted the actors to feel like they are in almost like a theater piece, a 360 1943 experience.
Talks about rolling camera for 45 minutes at a time, just trying to capture moments, and then from that he has constructed his film.
Exactly. And he talked, there was no lighting used in the entire film.
Yeah, which I thought was incredible.
And it almost
practical lights, but not sort of artificial.
And I don't know. I don't think this is true, but it almost looks like it hasn't been color graded. It's like he
very neutral. He's talked a lot about, I don't want the presence of my filmmaking to be known. I don't want any sort of style, any sort of effect to have been used.
So that's what brings me to my first point. So Glazer is very, when he spoke in the Q&A, it's clear that he's very, very cognizant of the dilemma and the problems filmmakers have when trying to capture something like the Holocaust on screen, right?
And saying something new about it as well, and not reiterating something else has said.
He's aware that the inherent apparatus of cinema can, if not careful, stylize, aestheticize, fetishize, empower its subject. So when you come to showing the unshowable and depicting the unthinkable, how do you do that in a way that is not distasteful? So, for example, Spielberg famously shot Schindler's List in black and white. Some people have said that the black and white Schindler's List is almost too gorgeous. It's a deep black and it's deep, but almost looks too nice. But for example, Spielberg decided to shoot Schindler's List in black and white. Son of Saul a few years ago shot everything in a tight close up and everything. Yeah. The horrors of Auschwitz were shot in a, you know, in peripheral and out of focus. And what Glazer has decided to do, and I think is very effective, is this perpetrator perspective, like I said, where everything is, you never see, as you said, Auschwitz, you just hear the horror. And I think the combination of those two things is incredibly effective, incredibly chilling, incredibly haunting. You mentioned Under the Skin. Glazer knows how to kind of do horror. I wouldn't describe Under the Skin necessarily as a horror film, but it's deeply uncomfortable and unsettling and has imagery that is very difficult. And what I realized when watching The Zone of Interest is that he is a really interesting filmmaker because he gives you the visual ingredients and he gives you the cinematic ingredients that you need to then make the film in your head and to go away. And there's a phrase that Paul Schrader, the writer, said once, which is that a good film starts when you leave the cinema. And that is exactly what you'll have when you see The Zone of Interest. You'll see it and you might find it confusing, confounding, because there are moments as well, talking about horror, of like deep surrealism and abstraction and violent use of sound.
Yeah.
But you come away and it will haunt your mind, and for the next 24 hours or longer, it will percolate and you will have almost the film in your head. And that residue is what is the power of the film. So it's the cumulative effect of what he's doing. And it shows, because in the Q&A, as you talked about his conduct with the audience, he was saying, you know, a lot of people try to sort of basically ask him what certain bits mean because they're quite obscure. And he said, with certain elements, he was like, well, I don't need to explain myself because it's on screen. Everything I want to, the way I've expressed it is on screen. I can't express it in any other way. That's how I want to express it. It's on screen. And I don't want to say what it could mean because I don't want to rob you as a viewer of your own interpretation of that and reduce what you thought about it. And I think that's brilliant. And I think that is what The Zone of Interest is all about, is providing you with stimulating, provocative, unsettling imagery, unsettling cinema that you will come away and piece together and have this kind of haunting sense in your mind. That's what I think is great. I will just say there is a couple of moments. My only slight reservation is that I think there was a few times that I became very conscious of it as a formal exercise, this contrast, this juxtaposition between the domestic and the horrible, you know, the horror. And there was just a few times where I was like, I've got the juxtaposition. I've understood the horror. I've got what you're doing here and the formal contrast. What else have I got to go? What else have I got to explore within myself now? And what else have I been given apart from just seeing that this is a visual, that this is a formal contrast? So that's a minor thing. But other than that, I think it's a really, really kind of staggering, haunting piece of work that exists beyond the cinema screen.
There was an interesting question in our screening where someone talked about film being used in education to sort of tell, like, you know, inform people about the Holocaust. And someone, you know, she praised the film for not being rated 18. It makes this more accessible as an educational tool for the Holocaust. 12A. And I think, you know, almost thinking about this as an educational film, it obviously does provide an insight to the Holocaust a certain way, but it doesn't, for me, sit, not as a criticism, I think what the film's trying to achieve, sit in that film, which is come and sit down and let me tell you about the Holocaust. I think there are many other films that are better at doing that. I think Schindler's List, for example, is better. The Pianist, even, of giving you a personal story and taking you through it. Like, a lot of the great Holocaust museums I've been to a great one in Washington, D.C., and one in Jerusalem, Yad Vashem, is incredible. You're often given, I think in Washington, you're given one person and you can track their journey through the Holocaust in the entire museum, and then Yad Vashem is this architectural experience that tells you a story. I think the decision in this film to not really have protagonists as such, but to use Hoss's family as a tool to frame a story, and as you said, leaving you with just your own feelings once you're done, is such a powerful decision that makes this film so effective.
I agree.
I think it's one of the most violent films I've ever heard.
But that's it, yeah.
And I think it was deeply unsettling from when it started all the way through to the very end of the credits. The credits forced me to be quiet and listen to them, which we were obviously going to stick around anyway for a Q&A, but the use of sound and the rising, I think the most intense part of the score is the crescendoing sound that happens in the credits. And if you know about what is going to happen next in history, that music and that following of darkness had a really deep, unsettling effect on me.
I will just say also on that point is that because a strange thing happened because we were having the Q&A afterwards. The lights kind of came up, but everyone had to stay. And so typically in a cinema, that they would let the credits play out and people would kind of shuffle out quietly, but people kind of started to shuffle in their seats. And you and I, though, were
I couldn't quite speak to you yet. Yeah. And I was still still trying to process this film, experiencing the end of the film, which is very vague.
Yeah.
And specifically what he does with score, which I think is really, really clear. I totally understand what he's trying to do with the credits there. I find it deeply uncomfortable, deeply unsettling. Some of the most sickening shots for me were watching Sandra Hüller's character. I think she's just brilliant in this as well. She's really a top actress. Just some of the most sickening shots were her showing her mother, who's come to visit them in this house, the garden, and just talking about, well, you know, I'm hoping these can grow over and this will be quite nice because it's come over here. And for her, it represents everything that her indoctrination would have told her is the perfect German life, a house in the countryside, father living very near to work with children that have space to run and play. And it's just sickening to see this person move through the space. And I just found that really, really difficult if you know. And
there's a similarly, sorry, if I with the mother-in-law, there's a line, with the mother-in-law comes to visit and, so it's Huss's mother-in-law, Sandra Hüller's mother, comes to visit and she's sat in the kitchen and she's just arrived, she's having a glass of wine or whatever. And she's like, oh, we had a terrible journey here. We got delayed at Krakow for an hour and the train was so hot and actually somebody fainted. And I was like, that is so uncomfortable because you're talking about your benign transport experience from Krakow to Auschwitz when we know the Jews were loaded on cattle trucks and it's just
and even when she mentions the, like, I think some of the sounds and some of the terrible things that are happening, Sandra Hüller just goes, it's whatever. Like, she doesn't even want to engage with it. And like I said, visually there's a cycle of sounds that happens in this film. Yeah. There's visual, you see the steam of a train bringing people in. You then hear the sounds of people being rounded up and shot and despairing. And you hear the sounds of people banging on gas chambers. You hear the sounds of incinerator and the cycle repeats itself.
I'm not sure that, I didn't actually think that was the sound of people within the chamber. I think it was just the sound of the mechanization of the whole thing.
But,
that's also what the film shows as well, is it's the industrialization of death. Yeah. It's the mechanization of death, in which you have meetings between German high command about talking about something that is a logistical issue for them. They could easily be talking about parcel delivery or clothes production,
war munitions being sent around.
But it's like, oh no, we have this amount of product.
Are you ready to receive this many people in this period of time?
Yeah, incredibly chilling in that respect.
It's like the monster in this is the, you know, you think about Amon Gert in Schindler's List, played by Ralph Fiennes, probably one of the worst monsters ever portrayed in cinema. If you've seen that film, you know. But like, there is no monster in this film. Yeah. I don't look at any individual character and think that was the atrocity. The atrocity is the complicity in it and the sort of the contrast between what is otherwise very domestic and benign.
And I think going back to the horror element, it's like the monster and the horror of the film haunts everything like a spectre. And Mika Levy does the score for this in the same way they did the score for Under the Skin. And I was thinking about the Zone of Interest, the music that they use in it, which isn't available yet because I wanted to go and find that horrific final track. But it just made me think that I think Mika Levy is up there with like one of my favorite contemporary composers for films. For films, was up there with Johnny Greenwood,
otherworldly
and Trent Reznor,
sounds that you can't necessarily place.
This, and the sounds at the beginning, but particularly over that final credits, is this. It's indescribable, really, but it's this awful, growling, horrific, high pitched choral element that is like grotesque but powerful, so powerful.
It captures the imagination,
I think it's brilliant. And then, again, this haunting spectre throughout, and these also sort of strange growls. Do you know the growls that will bubble up within scenes? You'll just suddenly hear like a drum.
You know. Usually, when we talk about films that are thematically completely different, we talk about like we'll criticize a film for looking like it's made itself up as it's gone along and not quite had a clear vision of what it wanted to set out to make.
Like Argyle,
or just like any of these films that feel like big studio films that never really stuck to the script. You think about these long 45-minute takes where I think he, in the best kind of way, didn't yet know what form this domestic visual element would look like. And he talks about filming this boy playing with his toys while the sound of people being executed is happening literally 50 meters away. And then there's this one really interesting scene where the boy goes and hears something, goes to the window and closes his window, but is he not quite old enough to understand what's happening, but knows that the sound is unpleasant.
Yeah, he flicks away and sort of he hears something that he really shouldn't, and then he flicks away in a way that's like a boy. Well, I thought it was like a boy hearing something that he shouldn't do, and Yeah. Not knowing what to do. I think the boy knows he's heard something horrific, but doesn't know what to do with it.
And doesn't understand it, not privy to the information. Just that format of finding something on the day that you shoot it. Yeah. It really works for this.
Yeah.
And it's very, very, I don't know what that sound is. I think they're testing the fire alarm, but anyway.
Yes, interesting.
But yes, the zone of interest, I think it gives us a top praise from us. Definitely go and see it. Please see it in the cinema.
Absolutely see it in the cinema.
If not for the visual and just for the fact that it's going to sort of take you out of the rest of the world, for the sound. I think it's so important to see.
I think actually the film is so carefully constructed. The sound design, everything, and as almost like a piece of theater that you really have to, out of respect, go and see it in the cinema. Terrific. And we'd love to hear what people think of it as well.
Yeah.
The Zone of Interest. Please let us know your thoughts at hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. But definitely the best film we've spoken about this episode.
Yes.
Yeah.
George, should we go through some of the emails that we get sent into the show single week? Love it. Love the energy. It's great energy in the studio today. Guys, if you wanted to send in your questions, your thoughts, your concerns, you can do by writing into hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. Bevan did. Bevan writes into the show and says, hello, how's it going? I thoroughly appreciated the movie suggestions. I did find myself... Bevan
had a heartbreak.
Huge news, Pop Kitchen. But, we sent her some heartbreak recommendations. Yeah. She says, I did find myself in the world of Tolkien, as recommended by James. Can't beat a bit of Legolas to soothe a broken heart. They're taking the hobbits to Isengard. Also, I went to see The Color Purple, brackets 2023, yesterday. I have seen the original and the stage production. Was looking forward to this new version. The performances of the central cast were absolutely brilliant, particularly Fantasia Barrino, who played Celia, and Danielle Brooks, who played Sophia. The large dance sequences with big ensembles were also fab. However, I felt very let down by the sound design. There were multiple times I noticed that the voice of the actor would be heard, but their mouth was not moving, or the syncing with the audio wasn't great. The singing itself was incredible, but was definitely recorded in a studio, so we lost that raw feeling on screen, making some of the musical numbers feel a bit hollow. Great job on the pronunciation of the Irish last week, by the way. All my love, Bev. I've noticed in a lot of films when they shoot the over-the-shoulder shot, when the person whose shoulder they're shooting is talking and their mouth doesn't sync up. That happens surprisingly a lot because they want the reaction but not the
I had noticed, and then Anna pointed it out to me, and then once you notice it, you can't look back. It's particularly noticeable in things like sitcoms where you're switching from multicam.
And they need,
single cam? Multicam? No, it'd be multicam. There are multiple cameras. So.
Yeah. You know what you can praise Tom Hooper's Les Mis for is that there was a real rawness to its musical performances because they were sung as you saw it in front of camera. It wasn't recorded.
Why don't they do that more?
Yeah,
that really was good.
Yeah, and all the singing in it is really good, apart from Russell Crowe.
Yeah, I like.
Which I could have told you before I'd seen it.
I think I've seen that film a few times, not for a while.
I've seen it twice.
I like Les Mis, and I actually quite liked that film.
And I thought when they did the Anne Hathaway "I Dreamed a Dream" one unbroken take in sort of a dark room of just the raw performance, brilliant.
Yeah,
she sort of talks through it.
A lot of people were very mean about that film.
I know.
And I think they just didn't like musicals, so go away. That's coming out.
They're
re-releasing that this month in cinemas, remastered in Dolby or something for the better sound. Okay. And if you look at the poster they've done for it, it's fine. But Amanda Seyfried's hand is too big for the hand in relation to her body that's grabbing Eddie Redmayne's face.
Oh.
It's a bit dodgy.
That's strange.
A bit of a dodgy Photoshop there. Anyway, this next email is from Ollie, who says, Barbie snubbed at the Oscars? Hi, James and George, George and James. Every year, there seems to be a debate that rages on social media whenever the Oscar nominations are announced. 2024 has been no different. This time, the major controversy seems to center around Barbie being snubbed by the Academy, despite receiving 8 nominations, the fourth most of any film that year, due to neither Greta Gerwig being nominated for director or Margot Robbie for Best Actress. I understand that with the themes of the film and the nomination of Ryan Gosling for Best Supporting Actor, whose role as Ken is in the film is simply essentially to represent the patriarchy, on the surface, it looks quite jarring. However, Barbie wasn't a film that was made for award season. So if anything, the fact that it has received 8 nominations, including Best Picture, should be seen as a remarkable success. Greta Gerwig was able to create a film which had an important message around patriarchy and feminism that also had mainstream appeal. Barbie was the highest grossing film of 2023, yeah, with the box office approaching $1.5 billion.
That is huge.
Yeah. Which shows just how much it appealed to and was enjoyed by its audiences. I think it was absolutely the right approach to create the film this way. However, there is naturally a bit of a trade-off between creating a film with such mainstream appeal and the highest artistic quality in directing and acting. Mm. The Academy and the film industry as a whole has long discriminated against films that are made by and feature women and people of color, and it still has a long way to go. However, in the case of Barbie, I struggle to see how either Greta or Margot can replace any of the nominations on merit, and I think there are certainly more egregious exclusions in these categories, namely Celine Song and Greta Lee for Past Lives. Ultimately, as we all know, awards are a bit of a nonsense anyway, and people should just enjoy watching these films, whichever films they choose, regardless of what anyone says. Love the pod. Sirens on my end. Best wishes, Ollie. Lovely email.
The Barbenheimer films, Barbie and Oppenheimer, in case you didn't know, are two films that, in my living memory, I've never seen so many different opinions being expressed about both of those films. The number of times I hear on podcasts or on the tube or just from friends that were like, oh, I thought Oppenheimer was amazing. What? That's just brilliant. And other people going, I thought it was shit, boring, long, no terrible female characters. And the same for Barbie. Some people like Barbie was the most fun I've had, so good, so funny. And then the complete opposite, oh, just pandering, this and that, not funny. So I cannot place those films with other people.
Yeah.
It's such a marmite for everyone.
Yeah, that's actually good point. I also think that your email is really good, Ollie. And
thank you, friend of the show.
Friend of the show. And the thing is that this idea that oh my god, they make a film about patriarchy and feminism, and who do they give the Oscar to? The Oscar nomination to
the guy.
Well, that's not true. First of all, you got to understand, obviously, Ryan Gosling didn't take Margot Robbie's place. Yeah. Ryan Gosling is in a supporting actor male category.
Yeah.
Margot Robbie was only in a category against other women for best actress, right? And, so there's not like he took it away. As we did a Film Bites that was coming out soon, might have already come out, we don't know, it's coming out soon with Ailish Morrison. And I don't know if this will make it into the edit, but she made a good point because we talked about it with her and we saw her. And she was like, Margot Robbie did get nominated. She got nominated for producer. She produced Barbie, and that is her nomination for Best Picture. Yeah. Why not? We should be celebrating that. And as Ollie says, we should be celebrating all the nominations the film's
film
got.
Made $1.5 billion. She's all right.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about Margot Robbie being able to get roles and pay her bills this year.
It's quite knee-jerk, lazy commentary from people to be like, oh, my God, what a snub.
It's a surface view look at the nomination.
Like Hillary Clinton writing the, saying, oh, Greta and Margot stand with it. It's like, I think, as Ollie says, it's done all right.
People are like, is Ryan Gosling not going to boycott the Oscars? It's like, no. He receives that nomination on behalf of anyone. Anyway, this next one's from Claire, who says, hi, guys. Welcome to my favorite season, award season, brackets, name the show. Just listen to your Oscar reaction episode. I don't actually disagree with all the points you make and who you think will win, but I wanted to weigh in with a few points and questions. While I'm sure, guys, we did a sort of reaction to the Oscar noms a couple of weeks ago, if you want to check that out. While I'm sure it's been this way for a long time, if not forever, the talk of who has the most buzz, who has the best campaign for winning, makes the whole thing so mercenary and less of a simple judgment by Academy members of who they preferred this year. It feels like a veil has been lifted on the glamorous Oscars and leaves me feeling icky. You touched on the story for some of the nominees that makes a good headline and can tick a box or pull on a heartstring. All this does is overshadow their actual achievements, in my opinion. Do you think I've been naive in the past, or do you feel the campaign element is more of a thing, cite Andrew Riseborough nomination in 2022? You call Oppenheimer the success of last year when talking about its inevitable win for Best Picture, but in your review of last year and listening to your reviews, Anatomy of a Fall and Past Lives seem to have much more of an impact on you. Shouldn't the winner be one of those and not a film that was everywhere? I'm not knocking Oppenheimer, but sheer success in marketing doesn't make the Best Picture. Otherwise, Avengers Endgame should have beaten Parasite. It's difficult not to be annoyed by the omission of Greta from the Best Director category, which does mean there's no chance of Barbie winning Best Picture, which does mean there's no chance of Barbie winning Best Picture.
Not true.
But I don't know who I would take out to make room for her with any 5 spaces available. It's a strong year, and Barbie should make its impact in winning writing categories across the board. It is fantastic to see a performance like Ryan Gosling's getting nominated. Comedic performances usually never receive net recognition. I don't know if the BAFTAs have a rule of 6 for their categories, but I'm more annoyed with their choices. Where is Greta in Best Director if Barbie has film, actor, actress, screenplay, costume, and production design nominations? Jacob Elordi's best performance is Priscilla, not Saltburn, I agree. It might not been released in time, but as he's the Rising Star Award, take him out of the main awards. Vivian Opara is nominated for leading actress in Rye Lane, but not Lily Gladstone. All of Us Strangers gets outstanding British film, best supporting and director, but nothing for Andrew Scott.
Make it
make sense. As ever, love the show, all the best. Claire, from your work email.
Just on the thing about why I said Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Seems like the
we're commenting on what we think will win versus what our picks were, I think. And we did actually comment on those. But
also, the reason I kind of said Oppenheimer is because that's of all those films, I've seen that film twice. Same. I mean, I've already seen Barbie twice, but like, you know, Past Lives, Anatomy Before, great films. I love those films. One of my favorite films from last year. I've only seen one of them once, and I've watched Oppenheimer again recently. And when I take my positive feeling towards that film and I add the, and I look at the overwhelmingly warm critical reception it had, and I add the overwhelming audience reception it had, and I also add in the overwhelming success the film had, then like
Nolan's position
you kind of arrive
well.
For myself at a slight kind of objective opinion that if that won Best Picture, yeah, that kind of squares all the things I'm happy with. Not that smaller films can't. Yeah. So I'm not saying that it should have won because it made a lot of money. If the film, that would go to Barbie anyway, but like it's more that is one factor to show its popularity that I personally, if I was to say what film should win, I would factor that in against those other things I just mentioned.
It's like should win, deserves to win, do I think I should win? And nothing's won yet, so we'll have to just wait and see what actually happens.
Just because I don't think Barbie's going to win Best Picture, but I don't think it's actually a major contender really at all.
No.
Looking at the race, not my opinion, but... just because Greta didn't get nominated for director, that's not to say a film can't... Just because the director doesn't get nominated is not to say a film can't win Best Picture. There have been plenty of films that won Best Picture but without the director being nominated, I believe. But people care. That's the thing. The BAFTAs are crazier this year. The Oscars are one thing, but the BAFTAs ones, I just don't make any... I don't understand. Anyway, this next email is from Craig about The End We Start From, the Jodie Comer film that James reviewed, I think, about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Hello, gents. Craig from Edinburgh here again. Here are my thoughts on The End We Start From. Essentially, it's like watching a streaming series with all the action or tension cut out, and you're left with the scenes where, if you're watching at home, you'd check your phone. I felt the budget
that,
hard.
So that, I agree. If you watched that at home, it wouldn't work. Other than that, I think The End We Start From was actually surprisingly good. But
I felt the budget hard on this one. The obvious missing action sequences and overabundance of tight framing close-up shots so you couldn't focus on any of the backgrounds too much all felt very obvious. They didn't want you to inspect the surroundings. Everything interesting, emotional, or plot-furthering incidents happened off-screen, and because of this, no emotional connection to the characters, the story, or the events, as well as no tension at all. I was given nothing really to hope for. About 30 minutes into the film, I realised that none of the characters except for Zeb had names. I think it actually bothered me until I noticed that all of the you, he, she interactions between the characters, it made me feel even less connection to them. I will say, however, that a semi-realistic depiction of what probably would happen were the UK to be hit by a natural disaster of this scale. Want to see this done 1,000 times better? Watch Children of Men. Yeah, I mean, that's great. Or Survivors, the British TV series from 2008. Rubbish. You're telling me that was good. Thanks again for the pod and have a great week. Craig, just on your thing about you know, the obvious missing action sequences and the overabundance of tight framing, like it means you felt the budget. Give them a chance. Like these films, you've got to give low budget films a chance to make themselves.
I disagree. I thought like the off what you're not privy to off camera is part of the strength of it, and I really admired it. It's I don't think it's a budget thing. It's just like a minimalist storytelling, which I actually think compared with other stuff we usually get in that genre, I found it very interesting, and actually it worked for me emotionally towards the end. But I do totally think if you didn't see that in cinema, it doesn't have nearly the same effect. Mm. It's true for all films, but you know. This next one is from Cameron, who says, "Hello, Jaws and George and James. Second time writing in. Hope you're both doing well. I finally caught up with your back catalogue, and I'm now condemned to waiting every week for an episode. What fresh hell is this? Special shout out to your 2023 review. I thought James's take on Past Lives was spot on. Me and my partner loved the film as well. It was heartbreaking, beautiful, and we're still talking about it. And I completely agree with George's favourite scene from Babylon. Such a great moment. I work in film and TV, so found it very relatable, if not a bit triggering, and thought the scene was executed brilliantly. I wanted to write in again because going through your episodes got me thinking, how do you guys do what you do? Your podcast is of such high quality, and I know you have busy lives which include full-time jobs, so I was interested in what goes into making each episode. Do you guys meet to brainstorm ideas, then spend a few days researching / watching films? What do you edit on? Avid, Premiere, Final Cut, etc.? And what's your approach to that? Is there a contingency plan if James gets arrested at the airport for having a Leatherman blade? I guess I'm interested in what the weekly production schedule of Pulp Kitchen looks like. Hope that's not too personal of a question. Obviously don't reveal any trade secrets. Sorry for the long email. Keep up the good work. All the best, Cameron, sent from my iPhone." Guys, come in. Team, production team, come in.
It's us.
It's us. We see films every week anyway. We do talk every day about the show and what we're doing and where it goes, but we don't editorialize it now.
It's we know that we're going to cover new releases.
Yeah, if we get early access to something, that's usually... it's quite easy to know just from the marketing cycle what the big film is of that week. We edit on Premiere Pro. We don't really research. We'll sort of independently make notes and plan our thoughts. Yeah. But I don't necessarily research for long amounts of time. Most of my time is spent editing.
I think also because we're trying to give... You know, we will have enough information to be useful for the film, so to say, you know, who directed it, what they've done before, and that kind of thing. And, but I think we don't ever want to... we're trying to give a review that's based on our feelings towards the film, you know? We don't want to have much... We don't want to... We've never actually spoken about this, but I think in a way it's like we're not here to break down all the production notes and give you all the facts. That could be interesting, but also in a way that like you guys don't have that going. Minutes. You guys don't have that when you go into the cinema. So we don't want to...
I think we've very clearly taken the structure and format of a radio format film review.
Right.
And we've taken that into our show. But yeah, it takes a lot of time. It takes an extraordinary amount of time to do a podcast properly. Yeah. And thank you for your compliments on it. We do just genuinely care that it's the best it can be, sounds the best it can be, looks the best it can be, and is consistent. And that's the tough part about it. But Cameron, you're very kind.
This next email is from Matthew, who emails in and says, "Hi both. Past Lives is up for Best Picture, but doesn't feature in any major categories other than original screenplay, whereas Naiad seems to be in contention for a number of categories, but isn't in Best Picture."
Check out George's review last week.
"Do you think there needs to be a review of the Oscars nomination process with the big snubs, including Barbie, Saltburn, and All of Us Strangers getting fewer nods than expected, where a film like Past Lives, which I really liked, is winning over Naiad, which I haven't seen, despite the latter getting more nominations overall?" That might have rambled a bit. Sorry, Matt. Well, just on that question, also what was touched on in a previous email about, like, it's all to do with lobbying, right? It's all a ruse, guys. It's all about lobbying. It's just like the film companies will... You know, the voting body is only so big, and those people are just people who make up a voting body, and they only have a certain number of time in an awards in the months preceding an awards show to watch things, because you don't want to get their attention too early because they'll forget about it. So, there are awards departments in every major movie studio whose job it is to make sure that people are thinking about your film and are voting for it. Not the public, the voting body. They'll be putting on screeners, they'll be putting on mixers, they'll be putting on Q&As, they'll be putting on...
By the way, the day after the Oscar nominations came out, I went to the cinema and there was already an Oppenheimer trailer with all the stars and the reviews and nominated for blah, 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 blah,
exactly.
blah. That was ready to go the next day in cinemas.
And ultimately it is, and therefore the bigger, the more budget you have, the more you can pay for the extra screenings, the gift baskets, all that kind of lobbying. Mm. It doesn't win Oscars. You can't pay for an Oscar, but it's like...
It's in the mind.
It's in the mind. That's the thing. And if you're a really tiny film, sometimes you get to break through, which is great. I don't know if that answers your question, Matt, but...
Two more emails today. Oh, and also, like, you say Saltburn is a big snub. Not for us personally, at all. But I know other people like that film. This one is from Huel, who says, "Hi guys, long-time listener. Absolutely love the podcast. I've listened to a few over the years and have never found one that chimes with me as much to the point where I can take your recommendations as gospel and dive right in, something I've always found difficult to do when recommending films by friends. Up until now..." Or don't be disappointed if we have a review an opinion soon that you just completely disagree with. That's okay. "Up until now, I've not had a reason to write in. That was until I watched Butcher's Crossing this week. Having just finished Red Dead Redemption 2 after 5 years of off and again, on again..." It's such a 5 years on and off again game. "I fancied a period piece of the same setting with a bit of a twist. I stumbled upon Butcher's Crossing and gave it a go. What a ride. Nicolas Cage plays Miller, an intense and recalcitrant buffalo hunter looking for funding for one last great buffalo hunt as the herds slowly shrink with the overhunting during this time. Fred Hershinger plays the college dropout naive enough to find this pipe dream. Jeremy Bob also stars as the expert pelter needed to aid the mission. I'm basically writing in because it has been a week since I've watched this film and I still have no idea whether I actually enjoyed it yet. Huh. The acting was good, Cage and Bob in particular lifting the film with their brilliant portrayal of hardened men with nothing to lose in an even harder wilderness. However, the use of gore and hallucinations to frame the feeling of cabin fever the group experienced later on in the story was so well done and powerful, it was actually quite off-putting. When people ask me what I've watched recently, I ask about Butcher's Crossing. I don't know what to reply with. It's a weird film that did its job so well, I came away not really sure if I enjoyed it. Do you guys have a film that has done similar? Is this maybe an example of a film that doesn't owe me anything, let alone a sense of enjoyment, content once the credits... a sense of enjoyment / content once the credits roll. P.S. I spent nearly 3 years listening to you guys on my lunch break, tucking into a meal deal. I concluded that James is a chicken bacon lettuce sandwich with salt and vinegar crisps and a can of Coke, and George is a chicken Caesar wrap with some Monster Munch and a Pepsi Max. Am I close? Thanks, Howell.
Not Monster Munch, never.
Chicken BLT, no. Salt and vinegar crisps, bang on, and then I don't like Coke. Never.
Really?
Yeah. My mum really did well. She never allowed it in the house. And you know, when you're young and if you've never tried Coke, you're just convinced that I don't like it because I've never had it. So I spent a lot of my childhood being like, oh, I don't like Coke. I've never had it before. And then I got old enough to just like have it myself. And I never understood Coke as a flavor. It's not a fruit. It's not a...
Yeah, it's nice though. I mean, I this is an advert. I know it's bad.
Yeah.
I only have, I would say...
So a lot of people swear by it.
Four Coca-Colas... A year.
Right.
But when I do, my God, I enjoy it. And you've got to make sure that it's either out of a bottle or a can, never a plastic bottle.
Yeah.
A glass bottle is what I mean. On ice. That I usually, my favorite time to drink a Coke is when it's so hot.
Yeah, that's what people, a lot of people say. Where some people, like serial diet Coke drinkers, always Coke a little, or they'll go to Five Guys and they get a Coke with it. I've never.
Oh, no.
And I try the flavor and I'm not anti it. I just don't, it just tastes sickly and chemically. So no, I never ever drink Coke. I do not have one Coke a year.
I don't have meal deals often.
No, I think if I do get a sandwich, it will just be like this sort of more premium ham and cheese one.
Why, you think the more simple it is, the less bad it is for you?
No, so packaged supermarket sandwiches are so bad for you. They have 40 ingredients in them.
Yeah.
It's terrifying, but I do like smoked salmon and cream cheese, but I know that is a psychopath sandwich. It's like ordering a fillet of fish at McDonald's. It's just weird. Don't do it. Here we go. You like a fillet of fish?
Never. I've never had it. Never had it in my life. So I wouldn't know.
You wouldn't. You're a normal person.
Salmon and cream cheese there.
If you'd said yes, I would have just... I was going to go and check something.
Just takes the microphone and everything. Anyway.
Sorry, just on the question of a film that...
Oh, can I just say, if you didn't know if you enjoyed it, you didn't, frankly, you might not enjoyed it, but like, you know when a film is, and it's just not about entertaining, it's like, you know when a film has worked for you. And if you're sat there scratching your head thinking, oh, did that work for me? You're like, Maybe not. It probably sits at a 3-star out of 5 for you.
Yeah. Guys, we still have plenty more emails. Thank you so much for sending them in. We will do our best to get to them in the coming weeks. Please do keep sending them in to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. We'll read them out on future episodes. George, should we end
with some games? James, we're going to play some games now, and it's my turn to put you in the hot seat. We've got 2 rounds today. We've got another round of Have These Two People Been in a Movie Together?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I also have a good old cast list countdown for you, okay? So, James, we're going to begin with the co-star combos.
That was
as
it,
we called it. Co-star combos. And I have some co-star combos. Uh-huh. I'm going to read them to you, and you have to tell me whether or not, yes or no, quick fire, have they been in a film together?
Okay.
Play along at home. Just checking.
Co-star combos. It's co-star combos.
James, are you ready to play co-star combos?
Yes.
Okay, have these two actors been in a movie together? Ryan Gosling and Amanda Seyfried.
Gosling and Seyfried. Ah, let's go for... No,
they haven't. Courtney Cox and Jenna Ortega.
Yes, Scream 6.
Well done. And 5. Michael Shannon and Bill Murray.
Michael Shannon and... Groundhog Day.
Well done. Jeff Bridges and Kevin James.
Oh, I'm going to go no.
No. Joaquin Phoenix and Chris Pratt.
Ooh, I'm going to go no.
No, they have. It was Her, the movie Her.
Oh, of course, yeah.
John Malkovich and Dave Chappelle.
Sometimes I'm going to go no, but is it a yes?
It's a yes. Yeah. They're in Con Air together. Amy Adams and Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Ooh, I'm going to go no.
No, correct. Harrison Ford and Ben Kingsley.
Oh. I'm going to guess yes, but I don't know what
yes is the right answer. The movie Ender's Game. If you remember that, the sci-fi movie.
I suppose it, yeah.
Ewan McGregor and Scarlett Johansson.
Ewan McGregor and Scarlett Johansson. I'm going to go yes.
Yes, The Island. Michael Bay's The Island.
Yes,
do you remember?
I remember, yeah.
And lastly, Emma Thompson and Will Ferrell.
Oh, have they done like a... I'm going to go yes.
Yes, the movie Stranger Than Fiction from 2006.
I didn't know what for, but it sounded familiar.
That's the one where she's the author and she's writing it and it's in his head and he hears it. But you did okay there.
That's good, yeah.
You know, some co-stars are like, oh yeah, they did a movie together.
It's always hard because the reverse psychology of people who just definitely have.
Yes.
Now, therefore, because you've mentioned it, the likelihood of them having been in a film together like actually significantly increases. That was fun.
Which brings
that.
Us nicely onto Casters Countdown. Nice. Because I saw this Casters and I thought, I can't believe we haven't done this one before.
Really?
So, James.
Explain the rules for the kids.
For the kids at home, Casters Countdown is a game in which I will read out the cast list of a movie and James has to guess the movie before I reach the end of the cast list. Mm-hmm, I will start with some famous people in there. Are they the leads? Are they not? We don't know. So, beginning with your cast list countdown, James, guess the movie from the cast in 3, 2, 1. Halle Berry.
Catwoman.
Pedro Pascal. Jeff Bridges. Mark Strong. Julianne Moore.
Is it Kingsman 2?
It is.
Yeah.
And we had Channing Tatum, Colin Firth, and Taron Egerton after that.
Yeah.
Kingsman 2, the golden pile of crap, I've heard. Yeah.
Didn't get on with it.
I've heard it's garbage. Real garbage.
Yeah, I didn't watch it.
No, I've never seen it. I've just only heard. But that cast list, I was just like, oh my God. I didn't mention Elton John and Poppy Delevingne as well. And Keith Allen and Bruce Greenwood as well, apparently.
You know, like the first Kingsman, I didn't mind.
Yes.
I thought it was funny and I thought it was like, you know, it breeded a new lease of life into the action genre. And it felt, even though it's probably not, felt quite distinct and individual. And then I thought the second one just didn't click with me. And I didn't find it as funny. I didn't find it as charming. I felt too aware of it being a film being played to me.
I think it got quite, I mean, it's got a lot of the problems that Argyle has, but basically I think also kind of then they didn't know what to do with it. Then they made a prequel called The King's Man, which I thought was so forgettable.
Terrible title.
I didn't even think that Matthew Vaughn directed that, but he did.
Oh, wow, he did.
And so I don't know what the future is of that franchise.
Did that make money? Like his Kings, they must be trying to do a Kingsman 3 with Taron Egerton and...
Kingsman back third sequel.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think Taron Egerton can go do better things now.
Yeah, he's a big star.
He's free now.
He's very talented
go on,
as well.
You're free.
Yeah. What's he got coming up, Taron Egerton?
I like the first Kingsman because it was kind of like My Fair Lady thing. You know, you're taking someone from across the tracks and kind of buttering them up.
Dream and Colin Firth,
Anyway, that was the episode that was, and those are the games we played.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Pop Kitchen. We really appreciate you spending your time with us. Don't forget, we post new episodes of this show every single Wednesday.
And continue, please, to follow us on social media, even more so now than ever, because we post content that is not on this show, on that channel.
Yeah, go follow New Film
Both
Bites.
Channels. Yeah, Film
fun
Bites.
Fun film creators giving their hot takes.
Yeah, the hot takes. It's really good fun. And yeah, so make sure you like and follow and subscribe and share and comment and just basically give us as much love as you can because it really helps us grow. We really do appreciate it.
Can you rate us on the app that you're listening to us on right now?
Yes.
If it's Spotify, if it's Apple, if it's YouTube, thumbs up. It really does help us grow the show.
If you are a person in any sort of position of power or you know someone who's in any sort of position of power, please recommend the show to them, please. And
Producers,
tell them what a great time you have while listening to it. That would really help us a lot.
If your name is John Spotify... Let's chat.
Stephen Spotify.
Yeah, Spotify.
And then that would be great. Other than that, check out our bonus on one day coming later this week. But I just hope you have a wonderful week.
Have a good time.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.